Distributing the Future, broadcast May 22nd, 2006. Tales from three conferences.
The future is going to be bigger than the past. There's going to be more happening. Connected systems, connected devices, connected data. What can we do in that world that will be interesting, powerful, and useful?
Changing the world through capturing the knowledge of innovators.
The future is here. It's just not evenly distributed yet.
Welcome to Distributing the Future from O'Reilly Media. I'm Daniel Steinberg, and each week we bring you the technology and the people behind what you use now and what you'll use next. This week we bring you three interviews from three different conferences. From Macworld, photographer Peter Crow talks about the first things he does when he imports his raw images into his computer. LiveJournal and Six Apart's Brad Fitzpatrick tells Chromatic about how he grew and sold his business and about the technology behind it in a conversation recorded at the MySQL Users Conference. Joshua Marinacci tells Chris Adamson what makes Swing swing in a pre-Java 1 conversation. Have you ever come across a file with a non-helpful label like img_2331.jpg? Well, it's a picture, sure, but what's it a picture of? Is it one of your pictures or something you got from someone else? If it's from someone else, will it even look the same on your computer as it does on theirs? Peter Crow joins us to talk about the first things you should do with your pictures when you download them from your digital camera onto your computer. If they're RAW files, the first thing he does is capture the default settings so that the images look the same on your computer as they do on others. Next, he adds metadata to the pictures so that he has a pretty good idea what the general subject is for each shot. And then, before he does anything else, he rates each shot on a 1 to 5 scale. Crow explains his flow.
The first thing that I want to do is I want to apply the camera RAW defaults. The settings that are the defaults for how the images are displayed, it actually makes those permanent with the image files. That way, if you open those files on another computer that has different camera RAW defaults, what we're going to see is the image file displayed the way I want them displayed. It essentially makes those settings sticky to the file. The second thing I'm going to do is I'm going to rename the file and give it its permanent name. Every file needs to have a unique name. I suggest that a date component is one of the a very easy way to generate a unique name for every image file. So after I've renamed the files, what I want to do is apply my bulk metadata. And some of this is going to be common to every image that I'm ever going to take, like my name and my contact information. Some of the information that I'm going to be applying as bulk metadata is going to be stuff that's going to be applicable to this entire set of image files, like summer vacation. Now, I may also, within that larger set of pictures, I may subdivide them further, and if some of them were at the beach and some of them were at an amusement park, I may say these get the keyword beach and these get the keyword amusement park. So essentially I've done this work that I can do to many, many image files at a time. At this point I would not be going through and writing the keyword Josie for every picture that has Josie in it, nor would I be trying to assign higher keywords that are more theoretical or, you know, more conceptual. I'm just doing the work, this bulk metadata work, work that can be done to many files with essentially a single mouse click. The next thing I want to do is rate for quality. The work that we do rating the image files for quality is going to help us with every step down the line from here on out. So that if we can look at pictures and say, well, that one's trash, we know we don't really have to do any work on it. Conversely, if we can go through and find images that we really like, we know that we need to really start paying some special attention to them. So essentially, we want to do this work rating the file so that we can leverage all of our work on down the line. In my case, I use a combination of both positive and negative ratings. So the negative ratings are like trash, throw me away right now. Or for my professional work, I use a designation of outtakes, which means throw me away at a later date, like, you know, the day after the check clears. And then I can start adding some positive ratings. In my case, I use the bridge stars in the following manner. I use the one star to mean present this image file to the client. It's a nice, bright line. And even if the client is me, what I'm saying is this is a good enough picture of whatever the group of pictures is, that this is one of the ones I'm going to want to see. Whether I've shot a portrait of somebody and I want to go back and say, well, these are the ones I really think we should be choosing among, or whether I want to go back to my beach vacation and say, well, show me the good ones of what I shot. I use the second star in Bridge to mean this is a file that I recommend. So if I'm doing a job, I've shot a portrait, let's say, and I want to tell the client, use one of these pictures. I'll show you all of these, but I'm going to recommend these. That second star gets added. Now, this is a very bright, clear line for me as I'm doing my edit. So I can say, this is head and shoulders above. This is one that you ought to be looking at whenever you're looking for a picture that fits this metadata, whether that's family pictures, pictures of, you know, landscapes or portraits or, you know, whatever subject matter you're searching within. I use the third star to indicate that this is a best of collection type picture. I don't use the third star very often. I think that there's value at being at the top only if it's lonely there, and we really want to keep this to something that looks a whole lot more like a pyramid than a light bulb. So we want a relatively few images on top, spreading out to a broader and broader number. So my third star gets applied when a picture is a best of collection picture, or for pictures that I'm making as a professional photographer, I add a third star to every picture that a client chooses as the select from a particular situation. So if a client has hired me to shoot a picture of a person, I shoot mostly people, and there's one that they said, yep, that's it, and we've taken it into Photoshop and we've done all the corrections, even if it's not my favorite picture of the shoot, it gets the third star because the client has assigned that value. The 299 pictures that I shot that didn't get used, client didn't pay me a penny for those. Client paid me only for that one picture that gets used. So again, this is a very bright line value. And as a matter of fact, I use that third star for any image that's good enough to go into Photoshop and have a master file made. That is a very bright line for me. I assign very few fourth stars to pictures. I don't think I've assigned four stars to anything I shot in 2005 yet. I haven't fully gone over everything in the year for that, really with a fine-tooth comb, but... And I haven't ever assigned any five stars. Maybe it's because I haven't shot any five-star pictures yet, but actually there's kind of a mathematical reason. And that is that, again, remember I was saying that we want to keep this in kind of a pyramid form. And as my collection of images grows, I'm going to hopefully be doing this for another 30 years, and I'm going to have 10 times the number of pictures that I currently have. So if I were to have 500 four-star images, in 30 years I'm going to have 5,000. That's going to be a much less useful designation. So I haven't really found a good bright line reason to go up over four stars. At the point at which my four-star collection gets crowded, I have a place to move. I'm fairly certain they're not going to be making any more numbers between 1 and 5 in my lifetime. So we're kind of stuck with this. And so I really want to give myself room to grow. A lot of what I outline in my book really is kind of future-proofing your image collection. And scalability is a really important consideration. And so I think it's very important to think about what happens when you have 10 times the number of image files that you have now.
Peter Crow on the first steps you should take when importing pictures from your digital camera to your desktop. Our piece with O'Reilly editor and open source hacker Chromatic about his dream language was so popular that we sent him to the MySQL conference with a microphone to interview other hackers. He sat down with Brad Fitzpatrick of LiveJournal and Six Apart. Chromatic talks to Brad about how he's grown the site from zero to millions of users with a combination of Perl and open source. Chromatic begins by asking Brad how a business model of no money and just our smarts is working out.
It was kind of a necessity going forward. It was a hobby project, and I wasn't about to quit school and go get VC funding when all my friends were running around telling me that was the worst possible thing I could do. I wasn't incredibly poor, but I wasn't exactly rich. It was just
you didn't have money to spend.
Yeah, I wasn't. Lots of servers. I had no money to blow on servers. I mean, the first two servers we had for LiveJournal were it was running off my personal server. I told the community I can't keep running this because my server is falling over. So if you want me to keep running it, send in some money. Well, you can actually buy LiveJournal some real servers.
Was that the start of your actual business plan? Or
yeah, that was.
Do you have a business plan?
Oh no, there was no plan at all. It was send in money and we can keep this thing alive. And I awarded everyone who sent in money by a little green thumbs up icon next to their name, and they didn't. That's all they got. There was no extra features. Or,
wow.
It wasn't until like about 3 or 4 months later that I actually started thinking, hey, we should award these people and give them some extra features.
Well, at what point did this actually become sort of a business for you?
I think it became a business in my mind when I got a call from my mom. She was like, by the way, if you're taking money, you know, you have to like pay taxes. And I was like, oh. Yeah, so she always took care of that stuff, dealing with lawyers and setting up the incorporation and finding a CPA to deal with the taxes and all that. So I hacked and she dealt with the ugly stuff.
Well, when did you start hiring other people?
That's kind of funny, too. I had a friend who was in a co-op program, Brad Whitaker, that I had worked with since we were both about 13 or so. Just we found each other on the internet. We had the same name, so we called our website the same thing, and Bradley Land or Bradley World or something like that. And we found each other on Alta Vista, ego searching for ourselves. And so we started mailing each other, and we were into the same sorts of things. So we were always doing contract projects, like referring them to each other. And we did one together once. So we had known each other on the internet. He was in Ohio. I was in Portland. I don't think we had really met for years and years after that. He goes into college, and his college program is kind of a six-month work, six-month school thing. It's a five-year program. Right. So he was complaining to me one day saying that he had to find a place to work. And I was like, oh, yeah, man, that sucks. And then an hour later, I'm like, hey, what am I talking about? I have a company. Come work for me. So he moved out and into my guest bedroom, and we moved the kitchen table out and set up an office out there. So it was two of us in my kitchen for a summer.
So pretty low expenses there.
Yeah, that was it. And then another friend from college, this was Evan Martin, he would come down. He moved down to Portland the next summer, halfway through the summer, and he was working in there too. And it got a little crowded, so we got an office. But I remember we would both be sleeping in, Brad Whitaker and I, and Evan would come over. The door would be locked, so he would sit on the front porch with his laptop and use the wireless from there until we woke up and opened the door and let him in.
How did you start, building up the infrastructure?
Pretty much it was just a history of trying something else, and then there was a new bottleneck, and then fixing that, and there was a new bottleneck, and that pretty much went on for 4 years. And there was really no money to throw out these problems. And if you looked for the answer, there was 100 companies trying to sell you something, but nobody out there actually saying any of this stuff was good. And the salespeople not really wanting to deal with somebody who didn't have millions of dollars a year. And even when they did finally want to deal with you, they were just asking you, well, how many users do you have? And how much do you charge them? And you could just see them doing like the math in their head about how much they're going to screw you over. And so we went through that once with an unnamed vendor, and it wasn't fun. So we started building all of our own infrastructure. And I mean, we would try existing open source stuff, and I mean, we still use tons of open source stuff. But whenever something didn't work, we would try to tweak it. If it didn't work, we would build our own. So now a lot of sites out there are using pieces of our infrastructure. So,
well, I remember your office a couple of years ago, we talked about this, and you said, you know, if I'm going to deal with a company I don't like, I'm just not going to do it. I'm going to go write some code and open it up so other people can use it. Other people don't have to deal with this company. Yeah. Sort of like a spite-driven development.
Yeah, no, it really is. I mean, after I had to deal with vendors so often, I got off on like commoditizing their market and just like putting the code out there.
Are there any vendors you actually do like?
We love our hardware vendor, Silicon Mechanics in Seattle. They've been great to work with. They're pretty much a white box vendor, but they actually use really nice parts and terrific service. We went through like 7 or 8 different hardware vendors till we found one that we really loved. So that's pretty much the only vendor we have to deal with now. We have performance problems. We just buy new servers and scale out. I think Ops goes and buys them, and I find out a week later that we just added 20 machines last week, and I'm like, oh, okay, I guess.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. It surprised me when I heard the rumors that Six Apart was going to buy you. I wasn't sure if you ever were going to fit with them, but
yeah, I think they were actually the closest fit. It was kind of funny, just about the time that I was burning out, trying to do 100 things at once, suddenly the whole blogging thing got really popular, and I guess all these companies are looking at these media metrics type Nielsen rating,
exactly.
Net rating things, and they're like, LiveJournal, what the hell is that?
There are a lot of people on there.
Yeah, but they're not owned by anyone, so then just all at once in like course of 6 months or a year, just everyone's contacting us, and so it was just good timing. So I talked to a lot of companies, and Six Apart just had the right feel. They're the most like what LiveJournal was like. And some of these companies, I would talk to them, and I knew it wasn't going to work out. So it doesn't matter, like, you know, how much money they dangled in front of my face. I just knew it was going to be a flop. So I'm addicted to LiveJournal. I'm I sit there all day, just like some of the other
people
just,
are.
Yeah, I spend tons of time a day just reloading my friend's page.
A lot
page
of people over the age of 25 are addicted to it,
yeah.
Which, you know, it has sort of a reputation for not being that interesting to people under 25, but, you know, like Jamie Zawinski, people like that, people really high in the chat groups.
My philosophy was always to appeal towards both ends of the spectrum. I mean, open up all the APIs and the docs and the code and appeal to the geek crowd. And if you get the geeks, they'll tell their geek friends, who will tell their lesser geek friends, till eventually they tell their parents and their total non-geek friends.
The Gmail invite phenomenon.
Yeah, I didn't really ever think of it that way. All my friends were geeks, so it was kind of, I considered it offensive to, you know, put up a system that they couldn't hack.
Exactly.
So, but I also recognized that, like, you know, a lot of my friends were also not geeks.
Right.
So I didn't want to confuse them. So I always had, like, you know, developer area was a little link on the left that was totally geeky once you got in it, but it had a big warning at the top saying, go away. This is not for you. This is out. Yeah.
Right.
So I think I've always tried to that philosophy.
Do you have a lot of participation in people who want to customize things or use your API to get data out?
I'm constantly surprised by the way there's a community on LiveJournal called like LJ Research where
right.
people just analyze the data and they're always sucking things in and importing things. It's pretty impressive.
Do you participate much in that yourself or you just go in
well,
there and
I just
wonder?
I just read it and watch and I'm amazed. You know, it's like I'm really glad that we let as much data be accessible as we do because
right.
I would have never had time to get to any of this stuff,
well,
nor do I know the math or a lot of this.
You make just about everything available.
Yeah, we try to.
Well, let's talk about some of the other projects, to how you make your infrastructure scale.
The heart of our infrastructure is Mod Perl and MySQL, like a lot of different sites. But rather than having a big MySQL installation, we have lots and lots of tiny MySQL, well, not so tiny, but relatively tiny MySQL installs, and the application is smart enough to know which one to use. And our caching is the same way. We have tons of the memcached instances around that network just caching little parts, and the application knows which one its data might be on.
Right.
Our file system is kind of a pseudo-clone of Google's, where just chunks of files are all over the place, and it deals with replicating all around, and if disks fail, re-replicating them. So we don't really have any big item at all. And all these components are pretty much written in Perl or C in the hotspots.
Right.
But
this is all on code.danga.com, is that correct?
It's at danga.com or code.sixapart.com.
Okay.
Yep.
A lot of it's available there.
Yep. So altogether, I think we have our load balancer, which is a Perlbal. We use that in addition to our hardware load balancer because it does lots of bizarre tricks that we couldn't find in any other load balancer, like internally redirecting a request between nodes that's transparent to the user. So we could do the auth and other slow parts in one stack and then redirect it internally to a like a high traffic, high throughput connection, you know, event-based web
right,
server.
Right. You've segregated some of your servers based
yeah.
on function.
So internally our requests can, you know, bounce around between like 40 machines or so, and to the user it's just one request.
Do you have people reusing the LiveJournal code itself?
Oh yeah, there's 60 some clone sites that are using the LiveJournal code base.
That's quite a few.
Yeah. I mean, it's bizarre things from almost exact LiveJournal clones or to LiveJournal joke sites where it's like certain role-playing communities use it
right,
where they
right.
can have their own increased limits and styles and stuff that they may not get, to things like the Alaskan Fishermen's Credit Union where they have LiveJournal like baked into their site that you couldn't even tell you were on LiveJournal. It just looks exactly like their site. It's just another section. So
there are probably sites you don't even know about there.
Yeah, I guess some companies use it internally as like, you know, their CMS and stuff. Yeah, so my official title at Six Apart is Chief Architect. Yeah, so pretty much I just involved all over the place, and I don't really have that narrow of a job description, so it's nice.
Sounds
it's flexible.
Fun. Right.
Yep. I'm really loving Xen lately, virtualization stuff.
Are you thinking about rolling that out?
Oh, we're using Xen lots of places already. Like code.sixapart, for instance, is
really?
Just a Xen instance. My personal server, I have about 10 or 20 somewhere in there. I mean, I'm always creating them and tearing them down. Somebody came in and asked me a question last month about some Apache 2 configuration issue, and I didn't have any machine around that was running Apache 2. So I have a little wrapper script that creates Xen instances. So I was like, you know, Xen create name Apache 2 test,
right,
memory 128.
Right.
30 seconds later, after the rsync and the initialization, it's on the network with its own IP. I SSH into it, and my key's already on there
right.
as root,
because right.
That's the out-of-the-box config for me. And app, get install Apache 2, tinker with something. About 10, 15 seconds later, I'm like, oh, yeah, okay, it works like that. Here, we had a demo working. And then after that, just destroy the machine. So, like,
that's excellent.
That flexibility, just also for testing a lot of our components that involve, like, you know, dozens of moving parts.
You can have dozens of moving servers.
Dozens of fake servers, you know.
Absolutely.
Where it's, you don't get the, you don't get the HA or, you know, the load balancing because it's just a single box, but for testing, it's perfect.
Right.
You could simulate machines crashing or machines coming off the network. You can, you know, pause the machine. And, yeah, it's really useful.
Are you thinking about rolling that into production?
Oh, we actually do have it in production already.
So when you deploy a new server, you can just deploy a new Xen instance?
Yeah, and you can actually live migrate them between hosts.
I was about to ask about that.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's really trippy, actually, to be have a machine running, and it does iterative copies of the memory in the background.
Right.
And until it's just about caught up, and then freezes it for milliseconds, moves the last thing, and all the program counter sends a gratuitous ARP out, and it starts up, and you never noticed.
That's good stuff.
Yeah, so we use it mostly for security and containment. So if new code we're rolling out that we don't quite trust it to, like, not run out of memory, we say you have 256 mega memory. If you abuse this, you know, your little kernel that's in the virtualized machine will kill it, but it won't touch anything else on the machine.
Exactly.
Or if we wanted to, like, say, video transcoding of or video thumbnailing, and we have dozens and dozens of codecs, some of which we only have, you know, binary-only DLLs for or something. And who knows that there's not some exploit in one of those dozens of codecs run in a virtual machine that can't do anything, and you have a well-defined protocol between the outside and the inside that says, here's a movie, give me a JPEG back.
Yes.
And if that machine gets owned, you know, what can they do?
You rebuild the installation and pull it out some other time?
You automatically do it. You know, if it doesn't respond in a certain amount of time, it's just, kill it and restart it.
Thumbnail for you.
I love Brad's answer that he knew he was running a business when his mom called him and set him straight. Chromatic interviewing LiveJournal and Six Apart's Brad Fitzpatrick at the MySQL User Conference. You'll find links in our show notes at O'ReillyNet.com/future. I'm still recovering a bit from last week's Java 1 conference, early mornings coupled with very late nights. Before I arrived, the Java.net team hosted a community leaders workshop. It was there that editor Chris Adamson caught up with Joshua Marinacci. Joshua was Chris's co-author on the Swing Hacks book, which has now been translated into Japanese. He's also working on a project for Sun to make Swing applications look better. He also co-leads the Mac community for Java.net. He tells Chris how he got started as a programmer.
I guess I started coding on an Apple IIe like many of us did way back when. Switched to Windows in college and Linux. And somewhere around, I guess, 2000 or so, when they started announcing OS X, I decided that's what I wanted. I wanted a Mac because then I could have a bash shell. Photoshop and a bash shell on the same machine would just be heaven. And of course, now I work at Sun. I'm working on the Windows look and feel, so I spend most of my time in XP and Vista, but I still always have my iBook next to me. Now, one problem with the Mac has always been that it's behind on the Java releases, but I'm very excited. Apple just released a Mustang beta that's at build 77, and we're only at build 85, so they're pretty close behind us. So I feel pretty confident that when Java 6 comes out, it'll be available on every platform all at once.
Now, you're also involved with the Swing team, and you mentioned you're working on the look and feel for Vista, but what other kinds of things are you doing with Swing over at Sun?
So the guy across the hall from me is Richard Baer, and he's the head of the Swing Labs team. And in particular, our focus right now has been on SwingX, which is a set of extra components for Swing. Some of them are things that we've always wanted, but no one got around to building for Swing. Some of them are things that are somewhat limited interest. So we put it in this project that's 100% open source. It's LGPL, and anyone can contribute.
Okay, so what's the status of the SwingX project right now?
We've been in sort of a alpha state for quite some time and been held up waiting for a few other components to make it. So we've decided it's time to release a real 1.0 so that people can depend on the API and know that it won't change. So within the next month, you should see the first beta, which means we're only fixing bugs at this point and we're freezing APIs. Some components simply aren't ready, and so they'll stay in the development branch. And the ones that we think are high quality enough for people to use in production systems will be in the 1.0 branch. And I expect by the end of the summer, we'll have a final candidate.
Now, I'm looking across the table here, and I see a book that is predominantly in Japanese, but at the top of it, it says Java Swing Hacks and has your name at the bottom. So can you tell us a little bit about being a Japanese computer book author?
It's pretty cool. It actually took me a bit by surprise. I didn't know that we'd sold enough copies or that there was enough interest in Japan. Perhaps the Looking Glass project has had something to do with that. One day I got an email from the guy doing the translation asking a couple questions. So I was pretty excited. And a friend of ours in Japan got a pre-release copy of the book and said it looked really great. They did a great job of translating. They even translated the comments in the source code and in some of the screenshots, which really impressed me. They went to some great lengths to make it a quality book. So I'm pretty excited about that. And now I can tell everybody that I'm big in Japan.
So is there anything else you'd like to tell us about your personal outlook for Swing as Mustang, with all of its client-side changes, gets closer?
I really feel like desktop Java is coming of age. It's kind of been the redheaded stepchild of the Java world. You know, all the action was on the phones and on the servers. And now we're starting to hit the limit of what you can do with a web page, and people want more. So now, and Swing is finally fast enough, the other desktop Java technologies, they're all really coming together now. And it's a great time to make some serious killer applications. And Mustang is just the, you know, like the next phase of that. So I'm really excited. The next couple of years for desktop Java are going to be fantastic.
Joshua Marinacci, along with Chris Adamson at the Java.net Community Leaders Weekend. Thanks also to Chromatic, Brad Fitzpatrick, and Peter Crow. Thanks to all of you who've emailed in your comments, criticisms, and suggestions. If you have ideas to share with us, send email to future@O'Reilly.com. I'm Daniel Steinberg, distributing the future is a production of O'Reilly Media. Special thanks to David Bettino for composing and performing this theme. Visit David at Batmosphere.com. This program was produced on Mac OS X Tiger using Soundtrack Pro, Bias Peak, and Audio Hijack Pro.